Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Metropolitan Community College on Noon Forum. On today's program, we'll hear a panel discussion on the topic Focus on Women as Leaders in Education. The members of the panel will include Louisa Palomo, kindergarten teacher at Liberty Elementary School and 2012 Nebraska Teacher of the Year, Lisa Utterback, principal at Miller Park Elementary School, and Sherry Cook, program director of Multiple Pathways for the Omaha Public Schools. The moderator will be Velma Crumbly, retired principal at Gilder Elementary School. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, March 26, 2013, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the panelists and do not necessarily represent those of Metropolitan Community College, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Barbara Velasquez, Coordinator of International and Intercultural Education at Metropolitan Community College.
At the church that I go to that's not too far from Gilder, one day the family sitting behind me was touched and almost to tears when they thought of their dear principal, Mrs. Crumbly, and how much they really loved her and how sad they were when they heard she was retiring. So for any educator, I always say that hearing good news about something you've done to touch somebody's life is worth everything, you know, far more than anything else that you receive in life. So I wanted you to know that when you got started here.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Well, I want to thank Mrs. Velasquez for inviting me because, you know, it's always wonderful to be thought of by your peers as someone who's a leader in education. This is Women Leaders in Urban Education. And a great leader once said, if you think you're a leader and no one is following, you're just taking a walk. Leader. According to Webster's Dictionary, a person who leads, a person who has commanding authority or influence. Welcome to Metropolitan Community College's Focus on Women Leaders in Urban Education. Sitting before you, we have three women who have demonstrated and been recognized by their peers and their community as leaders in urban education. I am Velma Crumbly, a 33-year retired elementary school principal, educator, and an advocate for at-risk students. Let's begin by introducing our distinguished panelists. First, we have Sherry Cook, and she's the program director for Multiple Pathways, and she will tell you a little bit more about what she does in shortly. Then we have Sherry,
I'm Sherry. So.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Lisa Utterback, and she's the principal of Miller Park Elementary. And
good evening. Mm-hmm.
And then we have Louisa Palomo, Nebraska Teacher of the Year. Okay, let's begin by letting them tell you a little bit about what they do. Why don't we start since we started with you, Sherry?
Yes, I'm the program director for Multiple Pathways, and the Multiple Pathways program is a part of the alternative education program of the Omaha Public Schools. But it is an alternative program's opportunities that students select. So we have acknowledged that a high school environment may not be the place for each and every young person. Each of our students' needs are different, and some of them, that's just not a good fit, either for the size or for the flexibility that the student needs due to responsibilities at home or a whole variety of situations. And so while longer ago the only opportunities within alternative education were more for behavioral reasons, more recently students have many options, or at least more options, outside of the high school environment. So they may select independent studies, they may select the Accelerate program, they may select Gateway to College or the UNO OPS program. These are all opportunities which may be a better fit for various students, and that is those are the programs that are connected with the multiple pathways that I coordinate.
Sherry, what do you work with on a daily basis? Who do you work with on a daily basis?
I work with fabulous young people who have not had a traditional pathway to a diploma. It has been interrupted frequently by illness in the family. Some of these young people are the primary caregiver mm-hmm. for a very ill family member and have been giving of themselves to help that family member get through that time. Others have had real tragedy in their lives. I have a young person who recently lost both parents. I have several who have lost both parents and are getting through life as best they can and needing to finish that high school diploma. I have others who are contributors to their family financial situation and are holding down one and two jobs while they're trying to go to high school. I have others who simply took a little while to grow up, and maybe they made a few poor choices about where they invested their time and effort as freshman, sophomore, and now they are a little older and wiser and saying, oh, maybe I really should try to get some credits together, and it's an opportunity for them to get back into things and not feel like, oh, I'm sitting with the freshmen because I didn't get my biology credit, but a very respectful environment for each and every student who is pursuing that pathway. And so we have many young people from a variety of pathways of life who are coming together for that common goal of getting that high school diploma finished in a more flexible, smaller environment.
Okay. Lisa, why don't you describe your current position as an educator in an urban setting? And I think that what we're trying to get to here, urban setting is different. And that's why we have these distinguished women here today. So, Lisa?
Well, I think first and foremost, as a principal of an urban school setting, is it's my job to create an environment where there's high expectations, where all facets and stakeholders within our school community feel safe and they feel welcome. Our primary goal, obviously, is student achievement, and everything else centers around that. We're really big on creating positive relationships with our students and our parents and guardians, because by having positive relationships, you create a sense of hope within the walls of your school. And we're able to do that every day because our teachers want to be there, and it's important, particularly in urban settings. It's not just a situation where, oh, I'm a teacher, I've been placed at a school, I have a job. It takes a lot of work. You really invest in the relationships with the kids, which give the connectedness and allow them to want to give their best back to you. And, you know, my day-to-day duties include everything from greeting the students, the overall operational of the building, but most importantly, being visible in the classrooms, working with teachers, providing coaching strategies and feedback, and just creating those relationships with kids where they know that you're there, you're following up with them, you're checking in with them, you're working with parents and providing any essential resources that they need to ensure that they get there and they live up to the expectations that we have set.
Okay, thank you. Louisa.
I'm Louisa, and I teach kindergarten downtown at Liberty Elementary. It also is a Title I school like Miller Park, and I like what Lisa said about teaching in an urban school is just very different than teaching, period. We were talking right before we started about how it's somewhat easier to teach children who come from a stable background who have all of their needs met, but it's a very different story when you're working with children who don't have their basic needs met. And so I've been at Liberty for 9 years as a teacher, 11 years through my college studies, and I work with arguably the best kids in the world. I work with all students. My class by itself are kindergartners, but because of the community model that our school employs, I work with all students at all grades. We're very much a team at our school, so it's not uncommon for me to have a fourth grade student spend time in my room, or for me to send one of my kindergartners to spend time in a first grade room. We try to use at our school what we call a full service community model. And what that basically means is that we try to provide as many supports for our families so that our kids can come to school every day. And we talk about how, you know, we can handle that our children don't speak English, and we can handle that they have rough backgrounds, but we can't handle when they're not with us. So our whole idea focuses on what can we do to get kids at school and staying at our school. And we walk a very fine line with our families, and we say, by no means will we ever do anything to enable you, but we want to walk alongside with you. So if that means that your child is sick, we're not going to say, okay, well, send them home and find a way to a doctor. Instead, we have a school-based health clinic. So we'll say, hey, in the meantime, before you get to school, can we have them be seen in the clinic? We network with our family, with our community, so that our families have what they need. And if you think about the downtown area, it's so rich in resources that we've made partnerships with the Children's Museum or with the Rose or with different lawyers agencies that live downtown to bring in support for our families. And that's kind of what I do. One thing that is unique about our school, I think, is that we've only been around for 11 years, so we're a relatively new school. But we try to be very open to the community and have anybody who wants to spend time in our school. So we have former Liberty students volunteering with us. We have representatives from all of the metro colleges who do their practicums in our building, whether they're education students or social work students. We have partnerships with the Med Center, so we have doctors spending time in our classroom. And we do this, similar to what Lisa was saying, to make sure that we're providing hope for our kids. We want our children to be hopeful about their futures. And research says that one of the best ways for kids to be successful is to have a clear vision of what they're going to do with their life. So for you to say to maybe a fourth grader, what are you going to be? And they may respond, a doctor. They may not know what that looks like. And so we try to have opportunities to build that for our children. So they may get to know one of our med students who's volunteering. They may take a field trip to a doctor's office. So they're really forming these pathways to their future. And then the other thing that we're really big on at our school is parent involvement. We have parents at our school every single day from 7 in the morning until 7 or 8 at night. We do a lot of different programming for our families, from sewing classes or technology classes or English classes. In the past, we've done GED classes. We were talking earlier about the GED program not having funding right now, so that hasn't been going on. But what we try to do at Liberty is, instead of saying, well, we think it's a good idea for parents to learn this, instead we talk to our parents and we say, tell us what you guys want, tell us what you guys need. And so last year our parents said, well, we'd like to learn how to sew. We're having to spend a lot of money stitching our children's pants and buying new pants. And so through a grant, we purchased sewing machines and we brought in a seamstress and we did sewing classes, and now it's more advanced and they're making fantastic projects. But it's just things like that that we do at Liberty, where parents are on board with us. And then on the academic side, we have a school-wide management system where we communicate with parents every single day. It's a small visual notebook that goes home every day. Parents don't have to log onto a computer and go through 8 windows to find out how their child's day was. They know the minute they get home. And we have, easily with our 670 families or students, we have 99% participation every single day. So families aren't waiting 9 weeks until report card conference to find out that little Johnny should be reading at this level, but he's kind of the class clown, so he's at this level. Instead, parents know every day how their child's day was, and parents love it. We've had Liberty kids graduate who their parents come back and say, why aren't middle schools doing this? Why aren't high schools informing us every day of how our kids are doing? So it's what we do at Liberty. We try to focus on doing what's best for kids and not so much what's easy for teachers, but what our children and families need.
And I think that last statement you made is very important. It's not always easy for the staff. It's what's best for students. And I think that's the difference in working in a urban setting is, you know, we're looking at what's best for the community, for the students, and that means their parents. That means their parents. Lisa, would you mind answering what caused you to select education as a career, and what steps did you take to prepare yourself for this career?
Well, I will have to tell you that I grew up in poverty. My mother had me when she was 16 years old. She's 57 years old, and she's still a severe strung-out meth addict. I never had the chance to know or meet my father, and we were very mobile. We moved around 7 times from 2nd to 4th grade. I was illiterate and was one of those kids that played the game that I didn't really want to go to school because here we were moving again. And once we settled into Omaha Housing, I realized that school was a place of safety for me. It was a place that I could break that cycle of poverty, and I just really felt a sense of connectedness to certain teachers throughout my career as a student. And I just, when I was in high school, I had the opportunity to work at Girls Incorporated with the same demographics of kids similar to myself, and then went on to College of St. Mary to major in education on an athletic scholarship. And from that point, I had the opportunity to reconnect with Girls Inc. in a program called Operation Smart. And it just drew me to the profession of teaching, particularly into urban education, because I was one of those children that was a statistic. And through the investment of educators in OPS, I was able to break that cycle. And so I'm very proud to say that I serve in the North Omaha community. And when you create an environment, my mother was one of those mothers that felt embarrassed to come to school because she knew what some of the teachers were saying about her before she entered into the building. And so I know that it doesn't matter where you come from. It matters the attitude that you have. We don't choose all the time who comes through our doors, but we certainly respond to how we treat them when they come in. And that's how we have been able to have the last 4 years, 100% parent report card participation at Miller Park Elementary School. And we have to be a little creative when we do that by going to the homes, picking up parents, providing funding for, as we say, a jitney driver to bring them. Some of you may not know, but that's a neighbor that needs a little gas money to bring you. Or we'll go to the homeless shelter and conduct multiple conferences with some of our families. And so I could just say that for me as a personal perspective, I came into the field of urban education because I know that it does work. And when you provide all the resources and create a sense of hope and you empower children to take ownership of their lives, you can break that cycle of poverty.
Do you believe your college education prepared you to serve as an educator in an urban setting?
Yes, Personally, I believe that my college degree at College of St. Mary prepared me to be an urban educator, but I also feel that my personal experiences growing up gave me the outlook and the mindset to understand how to work with certain demographics of people and to just be real. I do feel that had I grown up in a different socioeconomic environment, I may have not been prepared for the challenges and the opportunities that we have to serve in the North Omaha community. And so I can tell you that we had chances to go into classrooms and observe, but it's a little different when you come in and you do your 40 hours of observations opposed to being behind a desk and having a student come hungry or a student come from a situation where there's violence in the home. I will tell you my graduate degree certainly prepared me for the challenges and I say the opportunities to serve as an administrator.
Okay. Sherry, would you answer, when you started your career in education, were there significant individuals who helped you to grow to become successful on the job, and please describe?
Yes, I did my student teaching in Houston, Texas, and so that was a very different setting from the setting in which I grew up. At the time, Houston was recruiting heavily from Nebraska and Iowa because we had the best test scores in the nation, and they figured if they could get our teachers, they could get our scores. So I was part of this recruitment to Houston, and it was a very different experience and one that I enjoyed thoroughly. And I gained so much knowledge from my master teachers there in Houston. They truly were master teachers. I think of Ruby Dabney. I think of Mrs. Halpern. I think of those teachers that there. I had three because I had three areas of endorsement. And what I did, I watched them do was to treat the students with high expectations and to just model that, you know, it doesn't matter when life gets hard, except that that's when you buckle down and do even more. And you connect with others for support when you need it. And they just saw all the opportunities, didn't see the challenges in anything other than a way to seek solutions. I would say that those three individuals were certainly individuals who mentored me along the way. I also taught in Southern California in the greater LA area at Fullerton Joint Union High School District. And that was another place where there were both administrators and fellow teachers who really invested in students and invested in me in specific strategies in how to manage my classroom, in ways that were engaging for students and made a difference in the teacher that I became.
Okay. Do you feel that some things really can't be taught?
I do believe that some aspects of teaching really matter more in the level of caring and investment that the individual teacher is willing to bring to the learning setting than what someone else is trying to teach them about teaching. You can use the very best teaching strategies in the world, but if you don't invest in that child in a way that they understand in an urban setting, that child will not learn from you in most instances, because the children in an urban setting have frequently been involved in situations where they have been marginalized or feel marginalized and will not perform in places that they do not feel safe. And so they want to know that you love them, that you care about them, and that you are striving for their best, not that you are going to cut them down at the very first opportunity. And so that makes the biggest difference, I find, is that if you can create a rapport with your students that they feel safe and that they know that you are there for them, they will succeed. And I don't know how you teach that.
Exactly. That's what I found, is that they have to know you care, and first of all. And if they and you can't fake that. You cannot fake. They know. They know when you care. Louisa, has No Child Left Behind, because you were talking about Title I, helped urban education? If not, what type of government intervention can help public schools? Can you talk a little bit to that, or would you like someone else to?
No, I absolutely can talk about No Child Left Behind. I think that No Child Left Behind, and you're all familiar, it's federal accountability to make sure schools are progressing. I think that it's done a good thing in that it's brought to the table a sense of urgency for educators that we need to really take advantage of every moment that we have with our children. But I think that too many educators get caught up in the fact that it's one test and they skill and drill our students' little hearts out so that they can pass the test. And unfortunately, schools and students are labeled because of one test at one point in time. And often, what I would rather see is the government putting together a model similar to what a lot of our schools already use, where we use a performance growth model. So we take a baseline of where our kids are at the beginning of the year. We test them throughout the year to see how they're growing. And yes, they're still going to have to do standardized testing, but let's have other marks to help paint a picture of who the student is or who how the school is represented. And I think that things the governments can do besides, you know, holding schools' feet to the fire based on standardized testing is put money in preventative care, putting their money in wraparound services at school. Right now there's some schools in New York that are creating what they call promise neighborhoods, where federal money is being put towards communities coming together to make a promise to children that they will get them from birth to college, that they will provide services along the way to support these families in the schools until the kids are in college. And I think if we could see more of that from our government, that would help raise student achievement.
Would you like to add to that, Lisa?
Yes, I would. For the No Child Left Behind was originally created in the 1960s by Lyndon B. Johnson, and it was called the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. And the idea behind it was to kind of level the playing field and provide additional funding to impoverished communities, which would give schools, and I should say district and schools, money to provide more resources to, per se, wrap around. Mm-hmm. And I do believe that the idea behind NCLB is worthy because it ties teaching and it gives a sense of accountability. Mm-hmm. And it's really, I believe, in this profession, weeded out those mm-hmm. that cannot take, per se, the pressure and what's at stake. But I also think that what our government needs to do is they need to reauthorize it. The bill has not been reauthorized in the last two presidencies, and it's only been reauthorized four times since its original inception. And I think when they do that, they will be able to go to a growth model. And an example of that would be next year there's a bar that says every student in the state, in this country, has to be 100% proficient in math, reading, and writing. And what it does not take into consideration is if the student comes in, maybe has been mobile, 8 or 9 different schools, mm-hmm. the student's obviously going to miss out on certain skill sets because of the mobility rate. And teachers and schools and districts and states are penalized, and you're talking thousands and thousands of federal dollars that are taken away, and we're labeled as a failing school. When I look at Miller Park Elementary School, we have surpassed quite a few of our schools within the same demographics, and we're making major gains. In fact, our district is making major gains collectively, and we're not given credit for going from maybe the 50th percentile up to the 67th when you're showing growth. And so I think one thing that the government definitely needs to do is they need to reauthorize that and move, instead of tiers, to a growth model. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, that'll hold schools and states and districts accountable, because you're still going to have to show growth.
Sherry, one of our major challenges, I think, now in this year, is getting students to graduate. We have that's what you kind of work with. Can you expand on what we're doing to kind of get students going? And that's your program, isn't it?
Absolutely. That is what we do, and I am happy to say that the addition of the Accelerate program has been a boost to that effort by the district to help students who may not fit in that traditional high school model well to have another opportunity to approach graduation in a meaningful way. The Accelerate program actually began as a part of the stimulus dollars which came to the district through the efforts of the funding for the 2-year stimulus kind of effort to get our economy going. And the challenge was really for the district to try to do something new, something different. And, of course, we prioritized various areas, and one of them being dropout prevention. And the Accelerate program is something that was developed, and what it does is it takes the same standards, the same textbooks, the same teachers, but offers it in a more flexible way that's more tailored to students' needs and their situations. So instead of a student having to stay in school in these same 8 classes for a full semester and keep all these balls in the air as they juggle all the way to the end of the semester and get their grades and their credits all at the end of the semester, we turn that schedule on its edge, and students take one class at a time, and they're able to then focus on that class for a 3-week term. And they finish that class, get that credit in their back pocket, and then they start the next one. Now, for a young person who has a lot of pressure going on, or a lot of chaos going on in their home life. They got evicted from their apartment last month. You know, how do you keep 8 balls up in the air when you got to help mom move? And so you missed several days of school last week, another several this week as we get the gas bill and all of that deposit paid. And then, you got to catch up in this class and that class and that class. And I've seen many, many situations where students end up at the end of the semester with maybe 2 out of 8 credits when they're able to more carefully focus on one at a time, They seem to be able to keep the juggling going, as well as then if they do have to take a term off because, you know, life got overwhelming or I had to have this baby, then the students are able to take one term off and there's a fresh start never more than 3 weeks away. So it's really helped students keep that hope element alive and feel like life is manageable. And if I lose it for a minute, it doesn't mean it's all over and I can't start again for another 3 months out. And so the Accelerate program has room. Last year we had capacity for about 140 students at a time. We graduated 120 last year. And so that was a very exciting year. We're looking at probably more like 160 graduates this year. So we're increasing those numbers and striving to meet students' needs in new ways.
I think it's important that people understand that it's called life interrupted, and that's what happens to our students. They, you know, something happens. And I think that sometimes people think that students that drop out are just dropping out because they're not interested in school or they don't care. But I like how you're, you know, letting people know that that's not always the reason. And in most cases, it's not the reason.
That is exactly right. And many of the students that I have participating in these alternative opportunities, they are very bright. They are very dedicated. They just have a lot on their plates.
I was the principal of an elementary school, which, you know, that's K through 6 or pre-K through 6. And I had a child, and I used to talk to my husband about this. They dropped out in fourth grade. And people would say, how do they drop out in fourth grade? Well, they just stop coming to school, and their parents don't, you know, push them, and, you know, you do everything that you can. And that's like that urban setting, too. You have to keep going after them. And the parents are saying, well, you know, we have a ranch. We do horses, and that's what they're going to do. So they don't really need to go to school, and we need them here to help groom the horses and this and that. And so they just let them stay home. And then when you continue to go after them and say, we need your child in school, this is what we're talking about, they don't come, then you take and we kind of would just send somebody out there. And then the parents would start saying, well, we're going to homeschool, so you have to deal with that. So, you know, it was really hard, and they were bright. That's the thing. They're really bright. And so that's working in an urban setting. How do you keep them there when you have that on your plate? Lisa?
And I would like to comment on that as well. I think my colleagues would agree that when you're working in urban settings, one key factor that will determine a lot of success when you have kids that maybe are in crisis or families, if you've created and sustained those positive relationships with the families, they are more susceptible to come in to the doors of the school and talk to you about what's going on, put the cards on the table, as we say, keeping it real, and asking you for support in regards to what can you do to ensure that their child comes to school, and they'll do anything to make sure that their children come to school. And I can tell you a situation. We had a shooting not too long ago where a certain individual went into a home and did some shooting, and that parent brought a sibling to school the next day and said she wanted to be here today. And when you do that, and I know they're doing it at Liberty, they're doing it all around OPS, mm-hmm. that those relationships make a big difference. So when there is crisis, our families trust that we are taking care of their babies and that they're safe and they can be in school, so mom or dad or grandma or auntie, whoever you're living with, can handle their business outside of school, and the children will come to school.
I think it's also important to note, when you were talking about life happens to all of us. Everybody in the room has had life happens. But the difference, I think, is that we have support systems. We have resources. If my car doesn't work, I'll take my husband's car. If I get sick and call in, it's okay. I'm allowed sick days. But for a lot of our families and our students, they don't have those supports. So when their car doesn't work and they can't get to their job, they lose their job. And so we always talk to our parents about, we're in this together. And the only difference between you and I is that I had somebody, and now you have somebody. You have us. Mm-hmm. Call us, like Lisa was saying. We have families who trust us that we will maintain their dignity and do what we can to help them. If it means going to court on behalf of a family for an immigration case, we'll do that. If it means helping with funding so that they're not evicted, we'll do that. We try to do what we can to advocate for our families, not because we have some savior complex about wanting to, you know, save the world, but instead wanting to do what's best for kids. And in our situation, it means walking alongside with our families and sharing our struggles together.
And we do. Okay, Sherry.
And when I think about that concept in how that has played out in the lives of high school age students, many of them have lost hope from the perspective of they've tried to do the system and they just keep running into walls, and they get very discouraged that the system will ever work for them. And the whole idea that hard work and keeping at it results in success becomes something that they're not sure they believe. And so the importance of what we have been talking about as far as support becomes a part of their ability to keep moving forward in a positive direction and to actually build this sense that, oh, if I do stay with it, I really can get somewhere. And that is truly, I would say, in my years working here in the alternative setting and working with the Accelerate program in particular, I have watched young people who have walked through the door with 2 credits, and they are 17, 18 years old, and they really are not sure themselves that they're ever going to graduate. But if we can get them to get through 3 weeks and get a taste of success, that tastes like more. And they get a sense that, wow, I think, you know, that wasn't so bad. I think I can do this. And then when they do get to a point that life happens and they are seeking assistance or saying, you know, this is my situation and we can help them work through that, they learn through that experience persistence. They learn that they can overcome. And I would say that as I watch those young people cross the stage when they finally meet that graduation, they have now proven to the world that if I set my mind to do something, I can do it. I have proof. Look at my diploma and look what my journey has been. And to me, that is such an amazing and life-changing thing, because if they can continue to build on that mindset and what they've begun to do there, that is an amazing thing.
I think that, you know, the underlining I think that we keep talking about is you just have to make sure that they understand that you care and really mean it. Because if you care, then they will care. If you don't care, they've already been beaten up many times. So let's see. Describe the 3 greatest challenges you feel students you work with face as they pursue education. Who'd like to take that? Lisa?
I'll start. Well, I think there are a plethora of problems that many children, you know, throughout the Omaha area face. I think that sometimes, particularly in inner city areas at Miller Park Elementary School, I think some of the greatest challenges within our community is obviously the poverty rate and the violence within the community. And I want to specify that that doesn't mean that those children or those families are directly involved with our school, but, you know, there are some misguided youth sometimes that make inappropriate decisions, and it creates a situation where maybe children are afraid to go outside and ride their bikes or jump rope or, you know, walk around with their friends and things like that. And then I just think within our school community, there's a lack of resources, you know, and businesses within our immediate neighborhood. And, you know, that plays a part in providing resources. I think all the time, I always say, if I ever hit the lottery, I'm going to buy the old Mr. C's building, and I'm going to make a beautiful community center for the Miller Park area and have basketball courts, a soccer field, have a community center where our parents can come and get their GEDs and provide any type of other counseling services or guidance for our families. So I would say, in summarizing, you know, just the overall poverty, lack of resources, and then the violence within our community are the challenges that sometimes, you know, create a sense of tension for our kids, because they want to do their best, they want to give their best, but sometimes there's obstacles that get in the way.
Thank you. Share a success story that energizes you for the challenges of your profession, and I know you have many. Mm-hmm. So just think about one, Sherry, and share it. Would you like to share it with us?
It is hard to select one, as I've watched individual young people to cross the stage, but then not only to cross the stage, but to actually go on and take the next step. And I guess I'm going to select one young lady that we served, who was a youth in the foster system. We do have a number of youth who have come through the foster system, and that is just a real challenging place to be as a teenager. I think especially potentially as a young woman, you really want to know who loves me and, you know, where do I find my self-worth? And I think it's challenging just to feel secure in an environment where you might be living with one family 1 week and then you're living with another family another week because you had a conflict with that family. This young lady, we watched her actually move from foster home to foster home when she initially joined us because she was having so much conflict either with other girls in the foster home or with the foster parent. And so there really was no stable home environment. She was a parent, parenting a daughter. And she really had only about 12 credits, I would say, with 49 required to graduate. And she was approximately 17 years old. And so when you talk about the path before her to graduation, it was very daunting. This young lady actually worked very hard to be successful not only in the Accelerate program, but she was simultaneously enrolled in the Independent Studies program. So she would go to school all day at the Accelerate program, 8 to 4:30. Very long day, because that's how you accelerate your acquisition of credits, by putting in more time. It's not like you can just put more credits together without putting in the time and work and effort. And so then she would actually go to night school. So after work, I would go check on some programs at TAC or have to go pick something up because this was located in the Career Center. And she was there all day, 8 to 4:30, and then here she was going to school from 5 to 9 and getting more credits at night. And this young lady actually ended up graduating. She's gone on to beauty school. She'll be graduating shortly from beauty school. And she's got more plans laid out. And so she is gone on with her life and done very well for herself, for her daughter. And it's just exciting to see her not only graduating from high school, but going beyond. And that is always integrated into what we try to do for each and every young person, because you can only push on toward a goal if you have a goal. Mm-hmm. You can only push on through the hard things if you really have some sense of direction. And so that career development and is a real important part of what we do. So that's one of very many.
You know, I wanted to share one of the success stories about the little girl that tried to drop out in fourth grade, and we didn't, you know, you don't let them, because that's what you do in an urban setting. You just don't let them. It doesn't happen. But what we did is that you have to build those relationships, and that's one of the things that, you know, I wanted to make sure that you understood, is that building the relationship. They liked horses. That was their whole big thing. They liked horses. And so they had the Sarpy County Fair. And so, of course, the classroom teacher and I would go to the Sarpy County Fair. I had never really gone to the Sarpy County Fair, but because I had to build that relationship, you know, you put on your boots and you put on your hat and you go. And she did the Mutton Buster or something where they... Yes, and, you know, and just by me showing up, it built a relationship and built a rapport that she felt that she could, you know, that they wanted to do what was right. And so they gave it, you know, while I was there anyway, they had her come to school, you know, most of the time. But there were still times that she would stay home and help groom the horses or whatever, but, you know, she did come to school. And so I think that one of the things that we have to continue to do is make sure that we build those relationships and then also serve as role models We need to serve as role models. You know, just because they're in crisis doesn't mean that you have to say that you're in crisis too. You know, you have to serve as a role model and make sure that they understand that there is something that says there's hope, like you were talking about, Sherry. Let's see. What recommendations would you have for parents or family members of students in urban public schools? What recommendations would you have for parents or family members of students in urban public schools? Who'd like to take that? Would you, Louisa?
I'll start with that, yeah. I feel really fortunate that we're in a school that has a wide range of students. We start with three-year-olds who are in Head Start through our sixth graders who are 11 and 12 years old. And I think the most important thing that I would tell our families and our student is to have a voice, to stand up for yourselves and to advocate for yourselves and go to school and be present and sit in the classroom and don't ever be afraid or feel like it's not your school, because really, as we tell our families, we work for you. You guys pay our salaries. We are here to do what we can to help your kids, so please advocate for your kids. I would also encourage our kids to remain resilient, because it's a tough road ahead of them. When I think about how vast Omaha is, and I think about the children that we serve every day who have a lot of struggles and who live in poverty, and then I think about where they're going to be as high school students going to the same high schools as students who had very different upbringings for them, and I just hope for my kids to remain resilient and to know that they have such rich life experience that can really translate well if they focus.
Did you want to add, Lisa?
And I would also add that it is a requirement as part of Title I that you have a parent compact. Mm-hmm. And what we do at Miller Park Elementary School, and I'm sure it's happening throughout our district and maybe in different formats, is we meet with every parent or guardian that is a part of Miller Park Elementary School. They sit down with the teachers or myself if it's a student that's transitioning in, and we go over that parent compact and we tell them, you know, we know that sometimes we all have circumstances and adversity that we have to overcome, but if you believe in what we're doing and you trust us and you get your baby here every day, mm-hmm. I promise you, if you do your part, we will do our part, and your child will get all the tools necessary to be able to go on and be successful. And just that partnership is critical, and they actually sign the parent compact, and they do their part, and they show up for conferences. They're available mm-hmm. when we need them, mm-hmm. and that just gives them a sense of that, you know, it is a sense of partnership and community that we have to work together. It takes a village to raise a child.
And I think that many times, you know, there is people who really believe that some parents don't care. And I have never met a parent that didn't care. And I have never met a parent that didn't want the best for their child.
That's right.
And sometimes when you get that, you know, they seemed kind of obstinate or something along that line, that's just because they don't really know how to communicate what they want. But they want their child to be successful. They want their child to do better than they've done. Even if they're doctors, they still want their child to be the chief of the medical center. Whatever it is, they want their child to do better. We want to thank you guys for coming, because it was a good dialogue, and I definitely wanted to thank Lisa Utterback and Louisa Palomo and Sherry Cook.
I love to talk. If I could just say one more thing that's very, very, very important when we talk about urban education, and I get this question a lot. A lot of times people want to have empathy for children that reside in areas where there is a high poverty rate. Working in an urban setting is one of the most rewarding positions that I have ever experienced. And it's not about coming in, oh, these poor children. It's about coming in and saying, hey, we know you're struggling. We know there's issues going on, but this is your path to success. And you have to be on time, on task, on that mission, and have high accountability and expectations. And when you do that, when you set high expectations, your children and your families and your community will rise up. So just remember that sometimes schools that reside in school areas where there's high poverty, people tend to look at us. And I can tell you, we are doing great things because of those expectations, mm-hmm. the strategies that we're using from the district level, and the accountability and involvement of our parents. Sorry, I just had to preface that.
No, I think that's great. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture program from Metropolitan Community College on Noon Forum. On today's program, we've heard a panel discussion on the topic, Focus on Women as Leaders in Education. The members of the panel were Louisa Palomo, kindergarten teacher at Liberty Elementary School and 2012 Nebraska Teacher of the Year, Lisa Utterback, principal at Miller Park Elementary School, and Sherry Cook, program director of Multiple Pathways for the Omaha Public Schools. The moderator was Velma Crumbly, retired principal at Gilder Elementary School. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, March 26, 2013, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Barbara Velasquez, Coordinator of International and Intercultural Education, and Crystal Overmeyer, Public Relations Specialist at Metropolitan Community College, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Next week, September 9th through the 12th, is Omaha Education Week. We'd like to take this opportunity to invite you to come and visit our schools and to see what a fine job the teachers of the Omaha Public Schools are doing for your children. To find out which evening your child's school is open, just visit ops.org and click on Omaha Education Week. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.